I'm Bob and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April 26, 1993. I have a sponsor. He's been sober longer than I have and remains very active in AA. And he has a sponsor who has a sponsor who has a sponsor. So I kind of know that I'm working with some people that have learned to stay sober for a few 24 hours. And it's good to know that. I was attracted to him when I moved to Richmond in 97 because of the recovery that he had and what he shared and the way he was living. And it's been a great deal. I don't regret staying with that sponsor for the last 8 years. And I have a home group, Bonnie and Big Book Study Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet every Wednesday night, Christ the King Lutheran Church on Huguenot Road in South Richmond. So if you're ever in Bonnet area on a Wednesday night at 8 o'clock, we'd love for you to come join us. And we'll offer you some coffee and our fellowship. I want to thank Billy for inviting me tonight. Very kind of to be asked to do anything in AA. And I don't have to question why. I just have to say, okay, and I'll try and show up. I'm going to pull up my watch so I don't go over time. I got to remember my manners. And I have no idea where my talk's going to go. It's not written down. My sponsor always tells me when I come to speak, try and tell the truth. And I'll try and do that with you tonight. See, my sponsor knows me. And, so I'll try and do that. Golly, you know, I started picking up drinks as a kid, you know, and it wasn't any big deal. But I knew what whiskey and beer tastes like long before I could legally buy it. Picking up as a kid around the house. But I wasn't getting drunk. I was just, you know, drinking. But by the time I was old enough to get a driver's license and borrowing a family car and planning to go out on weekends, part of the plan was to go down to the ABC store and find somebody who might be willing to buy me some liquor for that weekend. And I'd give them some money and they'd go in and buy me some. I don't tell you because I'm proud of it. I'm not only breaking the law, I'm getting somebody else to break the law. But I'm not afraid of doing either one of those things if I'm interested in getting a drink. The laws don't matter. You don't matter if I need a drink. I've got to try to get some comfort that I never knew how to get until I found that drink. Now, I don't know where that longing came from, but I do know from a very young age, once I started to drink, I needed a second drink. We We had a family dinner one time, and somebody's idea was, well, the boys, they seem like they're growing up. It's about time for them to have a taste of wine to know what it's like. And so they had wine set up with the meal. And they said grace over the meal. And because I came from a family that had religious leanings and practiced praying over the meal. And they hadn't hardly finished saying grace that I had reached down and drank the wine. And they're still passing the food around the table, and I'm asking for another one. And I must have been 12. Because I don't know any better. I just know that something inside me felt like when I finished that first one, I needed another one. Later I learned after drinking some beer and whiskey that not only did I need more than one, but the pattern was set up that in order for me to fit in out there in the real world, I needed to be changed. I couldn't fit in out there. I just wasn't comfortable with just being Bob. But I'd take a few hits off the bottle or drink a couple of beers, and I'd walk into the dance and I could dance with the girls and I could have a good time and talk to people. And most of the time, I didn't get in any trouble or do anything crazy, but it just allowed me to fit in. And I didn't know how to do that without a drink. As long as I didn't get in trouble at that time, people didn't care. Whether a teenager had a few drinks or not. I mean, they just didn't care. I should have gotten into a lot of trouble, but I was real lucky. Saved my money one time to go to a trip to New York City with a drama club. Had saved up all year with other members of the drama club, and we had gone up to New York City to see 4 plays in a weekend. And took a bus ride up there on Friday. Got there Friday evening. They had told us if they caught us drinking, they were going to pack us up and send us home before the weekend was over, and we wouldn't get to stay. And we got to the hotel in Manhattan, and the first thing I did was get a map and tell people I was headed toward the UN because I really wanted to learn about the UN. And what I really wanted to do was get down to where I knew the Bowery was so I'd get somebody to give me some liquor so I could have a good time that weekend. Because you had to go through the Bowery to get from Manhattan to the UN. And so we did. I mean, I went and got the bottle and started having a party in the hotel room. And the only problem with that is that sometimes when I start drinking, I get a little loud and the party goes on longer than it should and it starts to draw attention. And the people in charge came over and asked where the liquor was and whose it was, and I said it was mine, and they took it from me. And that was the end of the consequences. I mean, they didn't take my money. They didn't put me on the bus the next morning. They just took the bottle that I had. Well, I learned, okay, I can go get another bottle. I just won't invite the friends and it'll be a lot quieter. And, you know. So I was just real lucky about the consequences, but, you know, sometimes I wonder, you know, what it takes for this alcoholic to wake up and see the truth. It takes a lot. I'm driven by self-will a great deal in my life when I go back and look at it. When I get into my story a little bit, I'm going to talk about recovery for me. What I've read and what I've heard in meetings about recovery. And I am certainly no expert on anybody else's experience with the steps, recovery, meetings, or the big book. So please don't think just because I've been asked to speak tonight that I come up here with any special pedestal to tell you what it'll take for you to stay sober or how to do the steps. What I share with the people that I work with is my experience. And they can either try it or do whatever they want. So if I say something that doesn't hit right with you, I'm not trying to create any controversy. Please don't think that. This program of recovery saved my life. And I don't want to mess it up for you. Anyway, I'm off the track. Let me get back. I get into enjoying the party atmosphere because the liquor now is doing something for me that I could not do for myself. It became a real driving force in my life. Because without it, I thought I was glum, boring, dumb. Like the book says, all sober people usually are. I thought that's what I was. Thank goodness you guys tell me that I'm just self-obsessed. I'm just thinking about me. I'm just selfish and inconsiderate. That's why I'm not having a good time. I'm thinking about me. Come to find out, if it started acting the way I did later, I ought to be depressed and boring and glum. Because the stuff I did wasn't real good. So I'm having a grand time. I get accepted in this college. I go off to college. I lose the parental guidance that I'd had all my life. That'll put some brakes on some of my stuff. I don't know if you've ever heard this or not, but Bob, you've got a lot of potential, but you're just not getting there. And, you know, I heard that all my life. I also heard lots of other messages like, you know, golly, if you can't be the best at it in the world, don't even bother. You've got the potential to be the best. You know, I couldn't live up to that kind of expectation then, and I can't live up to it today. Thank goodness you guys have taught me that just being Bob, one human being, sharing with another, is about as good as I can get when I'm doing this deal in AA. I'm in this party mode, and the only reason I'm making any kind of grades in college is the transfer, if I make bad grades, doesn't look real good. It's called Saigon University. Because I was going to college in the 60s, where if you failed, they asked you to put your right hand up and join the service. And so I was motivated to make some kind of grades. And I won't go into it, but I don't know many college students in the 60s that partied as hard as I did that wasn't around other stuff. I was not only around it, heck, you know, it was also part of my lifestyle. And I'll leave it at that. I know a lot about other stuff. But I respect AA. And this is about recovery from alcoholism. And so that use of other stuff is just part of my recovery from alcoholism. It wasn't the main show for me. The big deal was, you know, getting a drink and getting that instant relief about how do I fit in, how can I be a part of, and have a few drinks and it changes and I can be. And I didn't know it was progressing even in college, because when I started college, it was occasionally maybe one or two weekends I'd go out a month. And then I got a job my second year in college so I could drink more. And then I started going out every weekend. And then I joined a fraternity and started going out on Thursday nights so I could start partying on Thursdays. And I didn't even know that was progression. But that's progression. And becoming more and more of my life centered around either drinking, not drinking, or planning my next drink. Rather than being focused on, am I growing up? Am I maturing? Am I learning anything? Taking all this money from my parents going to school. What am I really getting out of this education? And what am I going to walk out with at the end of 4 years? And I probably didn't grow emotionally or change a whole lot in those 4 years. Other than I could tell you a lot about different ways to drink and party. And knew all about that. And all my friends were drinking buddies. I didn't have any friends that didn't drink and party. And now that I've gotten sober, I haven't seen any of them. And some of them live right in Richmond. Some of my fraternity brothers. But they haven't found these rooms. And I don't know whether they need to or not. But somebody told me I had some potential and I take these tests while I'm in college. And while the war is still going on, I apply to medical school and I get accepted to medical school. And instead of going into the military, I go to medical school. And it doesn't change. Only they just ratchet up the amount of time I need to study and the work I have to do. And full of self-will, it'll carry me a long way. And I just buckle and do it. But let me take an exam and have a weekend off and I'll look like I did when I was a sophomore or junior in college. Because I haven't changed. And I see these people doing well in school and are productive and all my friends by that time are getting into good jobs and they're They're getting in permanent, what looks like good, healthy relationships with other people. And the girls I meet, they put up with me for maybe a couple of months or a couple of weeks. And they're saying, I don't need any of that. You know, they don't need Al-Anon. They're just walking out. It's real clear. You know, that they just don't want to have anything to do with the way I live. And so I'm a lone wolf. Even in the middle of the partying, I don't relate, I don't develop any real lasting relationships in my life. I finished medical school and graduate in the middle of the class, but the joke was, you know what they call the guy that finished last in the class of medical school? Doctor? So, you know, I graduated right in the middle. You know, I didn't excel and I didn't fall out of the bottom. And that just kept the faculty from having to look at me, you know, which was just fine with me. You know, if I could stay under your radar, if you had any authority, I was real good with that. Because, see, by then I knew if you looked at me real close, you were going to do just like those other people that I had wanted to make relationships with. You didn't want to have anything to do with me after a while, and you were going to walk out. And you want to see the real bond. So I go join the Navy, and I leave Richmond, where I graduated from medical school. And I don't return for another 22 years to Richmond. Intermittently doing the same thing over and over again. Starting in a new place with a new bunch of people. Trying to get along, trying to stay out of trouble. But needing a drink. Start drinking, getting into trouble. People not real happy with the way Bob's acting. And getting a new set of orders and moving every 2 years or every 3 years or whatever. So in 22 years, I had 7 duty stations. Permanent duty stations. Not temporary duty stations for training and stuff on the way. I moved about every 3 years. Because that's about all I could stand the heat, was about a year and a half to 2 years. And then I'm on the phone constantly asking the guy who writes orders to give me a new set of orders, because I've got to get out of there. I'm doing what I normally do one night. I'm sitting at home, I can't go anywhere because I've got duty, but I can take it from home. And I don't want to be there. And I want to be somewhere else. So I'm just going to sit and have a few drinks. And my mind will take me somewhere else and let me be somewhere else. And be somebody else if I take a few drinks. And I don't have to be Bob. And I did that afternoon. And I can't even tell you what I had for supper that evening. And I went to bed early, which was probably passing out. And got woken 3 or 4 hours later and had to go back to the hospital and go to work. And that wasn't the first time. I'm not proud of that. But I went back and did my work. came out of the operating room, and there was a master of arms, an elf of the day. Now, the master of arms is like the deputy sheriff. He's got a badge, and he's got the authority to put people under custody. And the officer of the day is a representative of the commanding officer, who's in charge of the place. And these people have a lot of authority. And they said, "Doctor, we've heard that you may have been drinking, and we want to talk to you before your surgery." And I said, "Okay, but I just finished my surgery. And please give me a few minutes to write my orders and dictate my note and make sure that my patient gets into the recovery area so that he's to be well taken care of." And they said, "Okay." Because, you know, nobody in the operating room was complaining. And, you know, there was no throwing instruments or screaming or anything. You know, everything had gone exactly as it should. So they said, "Sure." So I walk my patient down to the recovery area and get them tucked in and do my thing. I'm walking back up the hall. And I hear this voice: "Bob, do what they say and everything's going to be all right." Now, that's not my nature. Now, I've heard other people share from the podium that they've heard that voice say, "Everything's going to be all right." See, for me, I believe that's the still, quiet voice of God talking to me, that He's going to take care of me. Turned myself into those guys, did what they told me. They took me down to the emergency room. They gave me a sobriety test, which I failed. Then they took a blood test to prove it. Then they took my keys and my wallet and told me where to go. And the next day, I was asked by the commanding officer to take my stuff and leave, that I no longer had a job there. And I'd be told what to do next. Before I was told that, I was had a boss in between the commanding officer. And he had sat down with me that morning and asked me, "Bob, do you think you have a drinking problem?" And I said, "Yeah, I think I do." And he said, "Good. There may be some hope for you. We thought you've had a drinking problem for some time." And he told me where to go, and the next thing I know, within the hour, Bill H. and Mike C. from AA came to see me. And Bill was a drinking buddy I had picked up 17 years before in my first duty station at the Navy. And we used to close bars together in Philadelphia. And so I knew Bill for a long time, and we kept in contact. But Bill had gotten sober about 7 years before. And so he was there that morning with another guy, Mike, who I had no idea he had any deal with any problem with alcohol or considered himself an alcoholic. He was a department head at that hospital. He was a respected, hard-working member of the medical staff. He was an effective department head He got things done and helped a lot of people. When he asked for help from the people that worked under him or the people around him, they listened to Mike and they gave him respect. And Mike sat down in that office and shared his story about what he was like and how he had gotten into trouble and how he had found a way not to have to drink. And he said it was through AA. And he said, Bob, you don't have to do this deal alone. And you don't have to live the way you're living. See, I didn't know any better. I was living the only way I knew how to live. I was really doing the best I knew how. And there he was, an example of the miracle of AA and how it had changed his life. And all I knew was how he was living today. And it didn't match the story he shared. And before he left, he lent me his book. And he told me to start reading some of the stories in the back that maybe I could relate. And to call him later and I could give the book back. I had tried numerous times to stop drinking. Each time I got a new duty station, I tried to stop. I didn't want all that trouble I had gotten into before. I just couldn't stop on my own. And here they gave me a glimmer of hope with some guys that had stopped for a while, much longer than I'd been able to stop. And they looked like they were doing pretty good. They called me up 4 days later and they sent me to a treatment center right at that hospital. I didn't go anywhere else. They'd offered to send me elsewhere, but I didn't want to go. Because after seeing those two gentlemen, I knew that I would have to stay sober when I got back in town. And if they were doing AA right there in that town, why did I need to go anywhere else? And so that treatment center took us to meetings 6 days a week and had a meeting the seventh day right in the treatment center. So for 28 days, I sat down and got to go to an AA meeting for 28 days in a row. And heard just enough to be convinced that I was powerless over alcohol. I hadn't been able to stop, no matter how bad or how often I chose, for a long time. Choosing to stay sober one day at a time hadn't worked for this alcoholic. In fact, I never read that in the first 164 pages of my book, which is supposed to attain our suggested program of recovery. And I know that trying to stay sober one day at a time didn't work for me. I've tried to stay sober for big deals in my life and been able to do that for maybe 2, 3, 4 months at a time. But as soon as that deal was over, I needed a drink. So I knew I was powerless over alcohol for a long time. But I had been unwilling to do anything about it. They had sent me to a treatment center 7 years before as a visiting professional to learn about alcohol treatment. And I had hung around that treatment center for 2 weeks, going to groups and going to meetings and all kinds of meetings, and learning about recovery and knowing in here that I'm just like those guys there, but not willing to do anything about my condition because that alcohol hadn't yet beat me into a state of reasonableness. So it took a long time for my life to become unmanageable enough to finish the rest of the first step. But while I was in that treatment center, I had a new desire to not want to drink again. And I knew my life was a mess. I mean, what I did was not only inappropriate and socially unacceptable, the charges they could have put on me are significant felonies that could have landed me in jail for a long time. And I'm not proud of that. They didn't give me jail time or felony convictions. And the state of North Carolina didn't take away my medical license. But I believe that that's because my God begins to forgive me long before I forgive myself. And it took me a long time to get over the stuff I did. Second step was real easy. I had been going to church all along. I had been watching spiritually minded people for a long time and wondering what they wanted, I mean what they had, but had no idea what they were doing to get it. But church was not keeping me sober, even though I was going. In fact, a lot of the stuff we do in our steps I was doing in the church, like inventory and sharing that in church, one-on-one, did not keep me sober. So yeah, I knew there was a God out there for me. And thank goodness, it says, a God as we understood Him. It's the second step is in the past tense. Because I was driven through the steps by the lash of alcohol, and my conception of God changes. It's not that old God I grew up with. It's a new relationship that you guys talk about. But I could begin with my old conception as long as it was a power greater than myself. And that's all I needed for a beginning. So initially I just flew by chapter 4 and that didn't have anything to do with me. Because I didn't know the difference between atheist and agnostic. And I wasn't atheist, so I flew by that chapter. And I got right down to it in how it works. And I was sick physically, and it took months for the doctors to straighten out my medical problems. But I gave it all when I surrendered that night. No question about it. It was as deep a surrender as I give today on a daily basis. And I gave that night when I surrendered to those men with the badge of the Officer of the Day the policeman. Do with me whatever you need to do. God just told me He's going to take care of me. As long as I maintain that kind of attitude beginning my day, I believe that for me, I'm practicing the principle of the third step. I went and did that inventory as best I could, wrote it down on a couple of pieces of paper, and took it to my priest and shared it with him. And that was a done deal. Walked out of there different from any other confession I'd ever done. Went home, sat in my bedroom for the hour, took the book down and reviewed what I'd done. And although I didn't have everything on my inventory, I didn't share everything, I did the best I could. It's not about being perfect here. It's about the effort on me that has allowed me to stay sober. Not by any yardstick where I get a grade. I said the 6- or 7-step prayer. I didn't know that it changed me when I did that. For a long time. But it had. Went and did that inventory and took those names and made a list of people I'd harmed. And I was confused. Where do I start? How do I get on this deal? And I'd been turned down for sponsorship by 3 guys, and I was just frightened to ask anybody else. But I was really up against the wall. So I asked this guy to sponsor me, who I had known for a number of years as a hunting buddy. And he was crazy. I mean, the other hunters said, watch out for him. Rick's crazy. You know, don't hang around him. And he'd gotten sober in AA, and he had changed. He may have been so crazy, but he didn't act crazy anymore. And so I went to Rick, and he sponsored me until I moved to Richmond. And he helped me get through that list as best I could. And I hadn't finished it for a number of years. But he got me started. So I didn't have to step on other toes making amends. My sponsor here in Richmond asked me if I was doing a daily inventory. And I said no. Golly, I've learned to be honest with my sponsor if I want to learn anything from him. Somehow he knows when I'm not telling the truth. I don't know how AA sponsors learn that, but my sponsor just seems to be able to look right through me when I tell him something that's not even the whole truth. He'll ask me, what's the rest of it? You know, I don't know how we get there. You know. He showed me, you know, on page 86 and 87, how to do that daily inventory. And I've got a little copy of the big book that I keep right at my bedstand. So if I have any question about the words I'm saying at the beginning of the morning when I roll out of bed or before I go to bed, I know where the words are and I can look them up. I've been doing it now for 8 years and memorized their part of me. But let me tell you, I can get wrapped up in deals. And I have to pull the book out and read it because my brain is going so fast and I'm wrapped up in something. And thank goodness at least two times during the day Well, 99% of the time, I can tell you I stopped and thought about, you know, God's in charge, not Bob. And what did I do, and can I do it better? Now, some days I pray a lot more and I meditate more, but golly, if some days I just get those two dimes in. Making amends in a 10-step promptly is sometimes quickly and sometimes slowly. I'm glad they didn't put limits on time. But we don't have time limits in the spiritual life. I don't normally wear a watch. Because my time is not mine. I've been born again. I've been given a life much better than I thought I would ever have. And when I believe that, what do I do with it? Do I sit at home and watch my favorite TV show or read my favorite book? Most of the time, yeah. But occasionally, if I really stop and think about it, I'll get off my lazy rear end and go help somebody or do something I've been asked to do or pick up the phone and get something done to try and help another alcoholic. See, I've been uniquely qualified because I have experience with alcohol and the problems that alcoholism can cause in a life, drunk and sober. And the recovery that I found in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I can help another alcoholic where nobody else can. Preachers can't do it. Teachers can't do it. Wives and friends can't do it. But because I know something about drinking, I can break down the ego of another alcoholic in a short period of time and make a connection so that they understand I know something about where they are. And then if they want what I have, I'll be glad to show them what I've done and what I continue to do to have it. How do I do that on a regular basis? I correspond with guys behind the walls. I've been actively writing AA members incarcerated for about 5 years now. And just when I'm sitting at home thinking about my lazy boss and what a low-paying job I have and why my kids haven't called this week and why my wife's not talking to me this today or yesterday, I'll go out to the mailbox and get a letter from one of these guys. And they'll be asking me about, what's this second step about? How do I know there's a God? Or, how do I make amends? I'm locked in the room. And I get to share my experience. Sometimes those letters come off of me real quick and I can just zip them out. And other times I have to put that letter down and let it rest a day and take it into prayer and meditation. Because today I know our words have power to change other people's lives. And I have to share that in a thoughtful, considerate manner. My first home group down in North Carolina, when I was about 3 years sober, elected me the intergroup rep, and I got to go to the intergroup meeting on a monthly basis and hear what was going on in that little town and bring that information back to the home group. And part of the deal was that because it was a small town, we couldn't afford to hire a full-time secretary to answer the phone. So we just had a little answering machine. And they gave me a key to the office because I was an intergroup rep. So many afternoons, after I had gone through my day, again driven by self-will, rather than taking all that stuff home, I would stop by the intergroup office and check the phone and answer any phone calls, make the appropriate referrals, because we had the list of the meetings and some 12-step volunteers and the Al-Anon phone list now, because alcoholics weren't the only ones calling for help. And I'd make those referrals and then call my wife and let her know where I was. That was new. And something was working. And I'd say, you know, there's a 7 o'clock meeting across the street. I'm going to stay for the early meeting, and I'll be home right after that. And she'd say, okay, that sounds fine. The boys are home from school, and it's okay, you know, so I'm good with that. See you about 8:30. And one night I was doing that, and a guy came down the street and sat on a park bench, and the meeting room wasn't open yet. And I didn't recognize him, and I knew most of the drunks of town after being 3 years sober and going to lots of meetings. It wasn't a big town, maybe 10,000 people. And I went over and talked to that guy, and I asked him where he was from. And he said out west. He told me some state out west. I said, don't mind me asking, you would be looking for the AA meeting that's going to start at 7 o'clock? He said, yeah. I said, good, we'll just wait here and wait for them to open up. And if they don't, we'll have the meeting across the street in the group office. He said, okay. And I asked him why he was there in North Carolina, so far from home. And he said he's on a journey. I'm only 3 years sober. I don't know what the man's talking about. But I didn't ask him, and somebody came and opened, and I went to the meeting, and I have no idea what was shared that night. And I went home. And I moved to Richmond about 18 months later, and I've got this new sponsor, and he's active. And one night he says, this Friday night I want you to go hear a speaker. And I said, one of the most spiritual things I can ever say. Okay, when my sponsor asked me to do something. And I showed up. And there was that guy from Colorado. And he was the lead speaker that night. And he said, most people think that we're here on earth in search of a spiritual journey. But imagine how the world would be different if we just considered that we're already spiritual beings on an earthly journey. Thank you for letting me share tonight.